America Reimagined with Dr. David Adler receives support from the Raymond James Office of Idaho Falls, located at 450 B Street, and the Idaho Falls law firm of Smith, Wolf, Anderson, and Wilkinson.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Alturas Institute's America Reimagined, a radio program that gathers experts from around the country to contemplate or imagine how America might be different under different circumstances, policies, programs. Tonight, we talk about books and bookstores. Everyone loves books. Books have changed the world, and when they haven't changed the world, they've inspired revolutions. They produce happiness. They create curiosity. They sharpen the minds. Everyone listening to this program is surely fond of books. And of course, booksellers have played an enormously important role in conveying those books all the way since the Athenians introduced bookstores in the 3rd century BC and more popularized by the near end of the Roman Republic. And they've certainly played a very important role in Anglo-American history. Tonight, our guest is a figure familiar to many of you throughout eastern Idaho. He is John Radford. He is the general manager of the Barnes & Noble bookstore in Idaho Falls, which he has served for 26 years. And John, of course, has a very full plate. He not only serves as general manager of the Barnes & Noble bookstore, but he has served nobly, I would say, on the Idaho Falls City Council for 5 years. And he's an adjunct professor at Brigham Young University here in Idaho. He is a product of Idaho State University, where he earned a BA in political science and an MBA. And it's such a pleasure to invite my good friend and colleague, John Radford, to America Reimagined. John, so nice to have you here with us tonight.
Thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction. I was inspired to teach because I got to take many constitutional law classes from Dr. Adler. So it's a pleasure to be with you again.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. And now you've provided me with all the street cred I need. So, John, in our time together tonight, we'd like to move through discussion of the history of bookstores, talk about the enormous success that your store is enjoying in a troubled time in American history. And in addition to that, I think our audience would love to hear about the role that booksellers have played since the times of early American history. And I know you're very familiar with a great story about the role that a bookseller played in pushing forward the cause of the American Revolution in that brutal winter, 1775-1776. Would you share that story with us, the good bookseller that you are?
So I had this long interest in political issues, and as I started my career in bookselling, I knew that bookselling played a central role in kind of influencing folks, and it was not that surprising to me as I read through some of my history books, particularly David McCullough, focused on John Adams in the biography of John Adams, focused on a bookseller by the name of Henry Knox, who many will recognize that name because of his proclivity for artillery, and he becomes General Knox and then the first Secretary of War. And he became that because of bookselling. And I don't think people really understand that or know that, but he lived a pretty storied life. When he was 9 years old, his father, who was a shipbuilder and very, I don't know if wealthy would be the term, but they were well off, squarely middle class in Boston culture. At 9 years old, his father is impacted by policies from the crown and could no longer build ships in the Boston Harbor. And so he flees, kind of leaving the family, and then passes away in the West Indies, and which leaves Henry Knox, a nine-year-old, in charge of his family for earning a living. And he apprentices with the local bookseller who was friends with his father and took pity on him. And so he, at 9 years old, started running books around and started learning the trade. And at that time, bookstores didn't just sell books, they actually bound books. So most of the books came in bound by just paper, but you chose your own leather cover and how you wanted it covered. And so he became adept at making books as well as repairing books. And then they were a specialty in stationery as well. But I think what was most fun about Henry Knox is that he began to fall in love with artillery and military regiments. And his bookstore that he eventually left his apprenticeship and started a bookstore He was all of 20 something years old. He was very young when he started his bookstore, but he specialized in London books. And in that specialty, he loved to sell military books to the British soldiers who would come into Boston and had been there for, you know, decades at that point. And he got to know these soldiers, and the soldiers would take him out and teach him how to shoot artillery. And then he would join some of the local artilleries that were formed to protect themselves against invaders. At that time, the French and Indian War was happening and they were worried about being attacked. And so in his bookstore, he began to understand that the revolution was coming. And he was really good friends with Paul Revere, which was a lot of fun. And Paul Revere and him were close enough that they had to hide their identities, because Paul Revere was kind of known to the British to be a sympathizer. But Henry Knox was dating one of the loyalists and daughter. And so it was important that he stay appearing to be loyal to the crown still. And so they had to pretend to not like each other. So Henry Knox would love to bring, when they were together in the store, they would try to give comments to each other that were off-putting. And they would try to be rude to Paul Revere. Henry Knox would always try to make it appear that he wasn't friends. But the Sons of Liberty all came through Henry Knox's bookstore. And what was talked about was that his genial personality and his charm attracted people to just come to his bookstore to just be there in that space. And it was a really important space in Boston at that time. There were 7 bookstores in Boston in the 1770s, and his was one of them. And it was the cultural center for a lot of reasons. And Henry Knox ended up being really important in the war, but that was his beginning as a bookseller, and how I think bookstores played a role in that revolution, that summer and that winter.
That is a fascinating story. And it reminds us, John, that the people who launched the revolution didn't rely merely on taverns where they could swill beer and boost their confidence, but they also gathered in bookstores, perhaps to discuss tactics and strategies when they were sober. And so the importance of that story that you tell not only is a window onto the machinations of participants in the American Revolution, how they had to seem to behave at any rate and appear, it tells us the important role that Henry Knox plays. And as you pointed out, he'll go on to be the first Secretary of War in George Washington's cabinet. So what a career, beginning in very, very difficult circumstances. Not all booksellers have started in those difficult circumstances, I'm happy to say. Your role as a bookseller in the Eastern Idaho region is a role that creates a great deal of prominence for you, because friends throughout the region are accustomed to coming into Barnes & Noble, seeing you, and drawing on your knowledge about particular books. And you seem to have, in many ways, an encyclopedic knowledge of these new books, because you can so easily share with your customers what this book is about or what this argument is about. Not every bookseller has that touch. And I suppose over 26 years, have you decided that that's an important role for you to play?
Yeah, absolutely. I think local bookstores absolutely need to rely on their booksellers. And those booksellers need to rely on their friendliness and their ability to interact and connect with their customers. You know, reading is a very intimate thing, because you're creating this moment in these books where you're either learning or you're escaping. And those are intimate things in people's lives. And there's a real connection when you can talk about books when you've read the same book and you've taken some of those same journeys together. It's a bit like taking a trip that was difficult together. So when you've shared that with people over and over again and shared books and then have them come back and share what they felt, what they read, it's very meaningful. And those things matter. And truth be told, the other thing that we feel like really matters in our bookstore is the ability to raise money and make sure that we get books into schools. And Barnes & Noble in Idaho Falls before the pandemic, we were hosting 80 book fairs a year from the local schools. And we had given away 1 million books in the last 11 years just to kids in Idaho Falls, just to the schools around Eastern Idaho. And I think people probably don't know that, but I think that, you know, customers gave of their money, schools worked hard to raise that money, and then they bought books for their libraries. And to me, what a tremendous legacy a bookstore can leave if they can put 1 million books into kids' hands. It's just amazing. And, you know, our city and our community will be better for that in the future.
You certainly are a very fine civic actor in your capacity as general manager, and to provide that kind of support, not only to stores, but to allow many, many organizations, nonprofit organizations, to participate to raise very important funds. Was that something that you introduced when you came to Barnes & Noble as well?
You know, this is something that's available to Barnes & Noble stores, but most Barnes & Noble stores will have just a few book fairs a year, maybe one or two. I just realized that in an area like Eastern Idaho, where people care about each other, and we had that charitable nature about our people, that it would really be a win-win for everyone. And, you know, we benefit by selling a few books, but the kids are the ones who win in the end. And I think that's really where it was most motivating. And I think what we need to realize is that our children can find their hopes and dreams in literature and in learning and in books and in ideas. And, you know, our children need that right now. They need to see a better world and have hope for a better world.
That's a very good point. Books help people dream. They inspire hopes, ambitions, and who knows what can be achieved by picking up a good book, becoming engrossed in a story, in a thriller, in a biography. So that's a very important role. I think every book lover understands that. I mentioned how prominent your store here in Eastern Idaho is. It's now well known across the country, because about 10 days ago, you were the subject of a wonderful page one article in the Wall Street Journal, familiar to our readers throughout the region and certainly across the country. And in that article, you were asked, among other things, by a reporter to discuss the status of Barnes & Noble in the context of the struggles and the challenges that bookshops across the country are facing. And the news is good for Barnes & Noble. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and what led to it in the Wall Street Journal article that the nation now reads and rereads?
Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning that. It was really fun to have Idle Falls in the Wall Street Journal, and then to have our store specifically there too. It was really a neat experience. Jeffrey Trachtenberg, who's a longtime retail reporter, been there for many, many years, reached out after trying to find a manager who he thought would have the background and the expertise to kind of talk about these things. And somehow he landed on me, and it was fun to talk with him and to go through that experience. But I will say that the most important thing that came out of that article is the hope for the future for booksellers and for bookstores. Publishing had a record year last year, up 8% so far is what the numbers look like. And that's a pretty staggering number when most of the retail sales were, you know, they were limited for months at a time. There was times where we didn't really have a lot of retail sales coming through our registers in the brick and mortar stores. However, because of ebooks, there were still people reading, and their ability to download those to their phones or to their e-readers. Barnes & Noble, on the other hand, while I don't know that our retail sales numbers were as great as that, we did have a profitable year, and we're very excited to have turned around, because Barnes & Noble for years was a publicly traded company, and for the last 8 years or so had not turned a profit and was very worrisome. And last year we were purchased by Waterstones Books from Britain, and the CEO of Waterstones came and has done a great job of kind of turning around our business, partnering with publishers and making sure that we have the right books in the right places, helping us as local managers be empowered to bring in the right books, let us decide what's displayed in Eastern Idaho that might not be the same thing that needs to be displayed in Manhattan. I think that's critically important, because bookselling is like politics. It's all local, right? In the end, as they say, and bookselling particularly needs to be local, because the people we interact with, the people who are spurring us to read, are the ones talking to each other. They're the ones coming in to buy those books, right? And so if your friend read a great book, then you're going to come into that store in your city and buy that book. And so critically, we need to make the choices. And I think that the more that continues to happen, the more success we'll have. And I'll be honest, as the store has become more local and as we've been making more choices, our profitability has risen. And I think that's only good news for across the country for booksellers like Barnes & Noble.
I was impressed with some of the detail in that article in, presented by the Wall Street Journal, down to the way in which bookshelves are organized and arranged throughout the store, as well as the choice to use round tables versus little square or rectangular tables. What's behind that, John?
Well, one thing that we literally understand better now as a bookseller, as Barnes & Noble, but I think all booksellers need to understand, is that we are an experience now. We're not a commodity bookstore. So we don't need to find a book based on an author in an order. What we want is for you to have a discovery experience. An example of that might be that if you walk into our U.S. history section, you don't need to see the McCullough book in with all the McCullough books. But what you might want to do is see all of his books on the Revolutionary period, like John Adams and 1776 next to each other, so that you can pick up both of those books at the same time. And it became problematic before because you might have had books on the U.S. Revolutionary period through eight bays, and you'd have to look through all of them to see what we had available for that. And so I think it's really critical that we use title affinity and get things together that matter to people who want to buy these things and discover these books. And so we've done that throughout the store. C.J. Box, a lot of Western mysteries are popular right now in the fiction genre. And we've made sure that those are together. And I just think all of that will help people discover more things to read that they know they trusted this, so they want to read this next thing from the same grouping.
You know, as you, I like the word you choose, that when people come into a bookstore, it's an experience, it's a journey. It can be a magical experience. And as people search the shelves and look at the tables for various titles and offerings, and surely the availability of your cafe, where customers can come in and grab a beverage or a treat, encourages them to browse throughout the store. Do you ever have a sense of how long an average customer stays in your store?
Yeah, that research is pretty clear. The average customer is in our store 2 hours and they want to be able to check out in 2 minutes. That's our challenge. But yeah, that's pretty clear that our customers are generally there for at least 2 hours, and that speaks to that discovery experience. It also speaks to having the cafe. I think it's critical that you have a place to relax, eat, and then wander. Starbucks provides a really nice experience, but they don't have this whole bookstore that you can go wander after you're done drinking a drink of coffee. So I think that's critical. And I think it's really why Barnes & Noble has succeeded so well over the years, and why it's such a trusted brand name. And now we just need to make sure that we make it profitable and build it for the future so that future generations have these opportunities.
Mm-hmm. You know, John, I noticed in the article a photo of you, and it was very impressive. You were in the cafe and you were wearing a mask to demonstrate your commitment to good science and medical practices. It was a good looking mask, let me just say. But how has the store been throughout the COVID period in terms of people wearing masks, not wearing masks?
I'll be honest, as we reopened, I think we reopened in May 20th, 22nd, somewhere in that time frame. The mask wearing wasn't as good as it needed to be, but we had to inform people that we wouldn't let them in without a mask. And that got to be a little difficult sometimes, but that improved immensely when the county implemented the mask mandate. And to be honest, since then, we not really had a lot of problems, and we have a lot of people that come through. I think being part of a regional mall where they don't know which stores are going to require them to have a mask, so they all wear masks in. But our customers have been very respectful. I think bookstore customers generally are well informed and, you know, respect what is known about this pandemic. And so I think we have a leg up on, you know, maybe just a grocery store or, you know, Walmart or somewhere where, you know, I could see where it'd be more of a battle for them. And I think all of our customers are very respectful, even if they may not agree. I've had some of those conversations and they said, as long as you're asking everyone, I'll comply.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, I know that your customers appreciate the fact that you stock yourselves with local authors, regional authors as well. And no doubt that helps you to appeal to people in a large region. I've sometimes wondered how large is the region that you serve, north, south, east, west? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that Jackson Hole is a huge part of our customer base. And even other parts of Wyoming, we're still the regional basis for them, right? And we know when the pass is closed, our sales numbers are impacted 10 to 20%. So we get a huge influx from Wyoming. We also, West Yellowstone and Montana, we'll get people from there. There is a store in Montana that's kind of equidistant from Yellowstone from us. So it's kind of interesting. But we do have salmon. All of middle Idaho comes to us. And then all the way south until you really get past Malad, because otherwise I think they head to Salt Lake from there. But we have a huge draw, and we think our population draw is about 600,000. So that really helps us. And the other thing that really helps Barnes & Noble is the medical community that's built up in Idaho Falls. So many people come for their appointments from all over the, you know, western side of the state and eastern side of the state and the western side of Wyoming, that they need some place to be while they're waiting for test results or they're waiting for someone else who's at the doctor. They can't go in with them. And then IRMAC, I've always helped lots of customers who have people there visiting at IRMAC and now Idaho Falls Community Hospital. And I think that the medical world helps us to have some people that would come. And then dealerships, car dealerships are the other place where I often hear people say, I dropped my car off and I told them to bring me to Barnes & Noble and I can be here through while they're fixing my car. So I think all those things, being a regional hub, makes a huge difference for us.
A very interesting interaction between the economic world and Barnes & Noble, simply as a gathering place for readers. Who would have known that the medical industry could well serve Barnes & Noble, or that people waiting to have their oil change would elect to come to Barnes & Noble? That's a nice story.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, Barnes & Noble looks for real estate near hospitals. They know this works. So,
well, they your executives know their business then. I think about your customers, and you have men and women of all ages and stripes and colors coming from the entire region. I know that some of your avid customers are members of Congress, colleagues on your city council, city leaders in other cities and states indeed. I bet they seek you out to have a few conversation about the nation's challenges. Do they come to you for a little insight and advice?
I do. I enjoy those moments when people that you see in the news are in the store and we get to talk with them and hear some of their thoughts, some of their genuine thoughts sometimes. And I'm always impressed with those who come and try to inform themselves that are in the political realm, because we have some who in the political world that don't always try to make that effort to learn the history of our country or to be more learned around the issues of literacy and the things that it can bring to them. So yes, not only that, but really famous actors too. I used to manage the Twin Falls store, and I got to meet Demi Moore and Bruce Willis. We'd close the store down and they'd come in and just shop by themselves with their family for hours on Sunday evenings. I got to meet Adam West, the former Batman, and Clint Eastwood. And so, yeah, there's a lot of fun people that love to come to bookstores, and we get to meet them. Yes. I have a funny story. I used to referee basketball as well in Southern Idaho, and I went and refereed a basketball game at the School for the Deaf and the Blind, which is an interesting experience, because when someone's yelling at you from the crowd, you can hear them because there's no other people talking, right? So I happened to be refereeing the game between the School for the Deaf and the Blind, the Idaho School for the Deaf and the Blind, and the Cutthroats from Ketchum. And John Larquette was in the stands yelling at me very regularly. And I thought, I recognize that voice. And I looked up in the stand and there was the John Larquette. His son was on the Ketchum basketball team. And I got to tell him later that week, he was in the bookstore. I said, hey, you were yelling at me when I was the official at the basketball game. And he said, yeah, I bet you could hear me, couldn't you?
You've had such an interesting career already, as you've just reached middle age, I suppose. And, you know, for those in the audience who are watching this on Zoom, they can see the incredible selection of books behind you. And these are not props, ladies and gentlemen, not props brought in from the Barnes & Noble store. You've been an avid reader for most of your life and obviously quite a book collector. Have you come across other book collectors and booksellers who were either models or impressed you early on?
Yeah, I've had lots of mentors in the world of books. I really love Bauman's Rare Books that's from the East Coast, but they have a store in Las Vegas and I've spent a lot of time there. they're out of my price range often because they have amazing products, but it's fun to dream there. We have a very regular customer who regularly buys first editions, and so he's been helpful to me. And you know, I have some very worthwhile first editions having worked at the store. I remember the day J.K. Rowling was outed as that she had written under a pen name, under Robert Galbraith, and I had some of those first editions still on the shelf, so I hurried and bought one. So yeah, we have a really interesting group of people who keeps their eye on books, and first editions can still be very valuable in the modern age, but you have to kind of seek out books that aren't highly known at the time to be valuable, because print runs can be so large now. A new John Grisham novel will be printed in millions of copies in their first print run, so of course they have very little value. But sometimes a book like All the Lights You Cannot See by Anthony Doerr will hit the big time and win the Pulitzer Prize, but his initial print run might have only been 10,000 books. And then you have something very valuable if you'd picked it up. The other people I've looked up to over the years is, you know, Sam Weller in Utah. Salt Lake City was kind of known as the hub of the West for rare and unique books. And some of that was the LDS influence and all the LDS titles that came out of there. But I think there was a standard set there that that we should care for antiquarian books, and they matter. I really like to collect the mid, like from 1890 to 1920, because they're at an affordable price range and I can find them pretty regularly. I have a few versions of Les Mis in that time frame. And I also really like political works. Like I have a lot of sets around the Roman kind of period and things like that. And there's a lot of those types of books that are available at an affordable price for collectors that are fun to have on your shelf.
That's great. John, I'm afraid our time together is going by so quickly. It's been a great pleasure to host you, and we look forward to your return in the not too distant future. You are a gem of a citizen, and you are a towering pillar of strength for the community. We thank you for all that you do, not only to promote books, but for your civic participation. And so again, thanks for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. It's so fun to talk about books and bookstores. So there's no hard times there talking about that.
We'll do it again. So ladies and gentlemen, please sit back and enjoy the beautiful arrangement of America the Beautiful by our friend and brilliant musician Steve Eaton. The lyrics are performed by Idaho State Senator Cherie Buckner Webb and the 8-year-old phenom Laval. Thank you very much. Take care.
America Reimagined with Dr. David Adler receives support from the Raymond James Office of Idaho Falls, located at 450 B Street, and the Idaho Falls law firm of Smith, Wolf, Anderson, and Wilkinson. Join us every Wednesday at 7:30 p.m. for America Reimagined on KISU FM. All past episodes are available to listen to by visiting kisu.org/programs.
From sea to shine.